And so I got to be a Ninja Turtle. When they made the television version of it, they called it Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, The Next Mutation. And they added another turtle. Oh, this is embarrassing. I should never have began this trail. They made a new one, and they wanted a demographic that attracted women, so they created Venus de Milo. And I was the girl turtle. Yay me.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for TheMagicWordPodcast.com. This week we have the first of a two-part podcast with International President of the International Brotherhood of Magicians, Mr. Sean Farquhar. Not only that, Sean has won a multitude of magic awards, including FISM's Grand Prix World Champion of Magic in Beijing, China in 2009. That's why his website is magicchampion.com, with only one C, by the way. He explains it all in this podcast. Sean is one of those guys who you just have to ask one question, and he talks for over a half hour with such fascinating stories. Well, I asked two questions, which is why this is a two-part podcast. We went in a completely different direction right from the get-go as we quickly veered off the trail into his background as a special effects coordinator and the many interesting stories with rather well-known celebrities from television and film. Well, enough for me, even though this may be the most you'll hear from me as Sean takes over the microphone right here on The Magic Word.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for TheMagicWordPodcast.com, and I have with me today the current international president of the International Brotherhood of Magicians, Mr. Sean Farquhar. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Scotty, how are you?
I am great. Good to have you here on the podcast then today. And it's not just being the international president, but there are so many things that you have done in being a FISM winner, and how many awards actually? I mean, your magicchampion.com is your website.
So buy that website. A dear friend who was a marketing director for a company in Texas gave it to me as a gift. And it was funny, I just won the IBM in Orlando, Florida, So that's a long time ago. And as I came back to the desk, a gentleman at the reception desk said, "Are you Sean Farquhar?" And I was like, "Yes." He said, "I have two envelopes for you." He said, "Two envelopes." He said, "Did you win or lose tonight?" I went, "I won." And he handed me an envelope and put the other one in the trash. And I had no idea what was going on. I tore open the envelope, and inside it said, "I bought you a domain name, magicchampion.com. Enjoy." And all I was thinking was, does the other one have magicloser.com?
Yeah, you never know.
I never knew. But he was a very cool guy to do that for me. And it was funny. And it was because he was a marketing director for a large software company that I worked for. And he said, "Finding you on the internet is impossible." I said, "Well, it's SeanFarquhar.com." He goes, "Right. Spell Sean. Spell Farquhar. Give me a break. I can never find you." He says, "Magic Champion, can't lose that." And, he gave it to me.
But with only one C.
With one C, because I thought it was clever, because I used to do magic, and I had Magic Corporate, which was a shared C, and Magic Cruising, which is a shared C, and Magic Cinema for my movies, which was all, so then I had Magic Comedy, all with a shared C in all my advertising. So he went, "Magic Champion just fits over top of that, Corporate, Comedy, and Cinema. It's the perfect tie-in, so I'll buy you the site, and it'll be magicchampion.com. And I laughed, because I said, "You couldn't afford both consonants?" And he said, "No, you know, they charge by the letter, so."
Now, Magic Cinema, wait a minute. So what movies, what cinema were you involved with?
I technical director for special effects, X-Files, Highlander, Outer Limits. Recently I've done The Fringe, Arrow, Outer Limits.
Consulting, like doing
consulting,
what do you mean
special
exactly?
Effects, blowing things up, Poltergeist, The Legacy. I did a thing
you mean with electronics or with explosives? Or
practical effects. Instead of anytime, you know, they can do something with CGI, like every Star Wars film in the world, or they can do a practical effect. The practical effects are one-tenth of the cost of a special effect, and the actors get to react to them because they can see the effect as opposed to imagining there's a dragon or you know, a ball of flames or something. And so I worked for a guy named Gary Peller Special Effects, and we worked on movies like Needful Things with Stephen King, and It for Stephen King, tons of films, and blew stuff up, the television show called The Sentinel, and burned entire towns down.
Was that something you were always interested in as a child, with burning up things?
I had no interest. Here's what happened. I was doing this comedy club, and I heckled a person, and he followed me home and burned my home to the ground. And it made the news. And while I was doing the news, talking about how I lost everything in my life, this fellow that was working on a movie called Fly 2 the sequel to The Fly.
With Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff Goldblum was only in the first one. In the second one, it was now I got to think of his name. Daphne Zuniga played the love lead instead of. I'm losing my head here. What's the fellow's name who was the actor? Anyways, I'll think of it in a second. Not the nicest man I've worked with. I did this film, and the way the film came up was the producer saw the television news talking about how my house had burned down. But I wasn't really sad. You know, I get a really good attitude. I kept smiling. They were going, so it must be depressing. I said, when the fire trucks came, I was going, burning down the house, my house. And when they started boarding up the walls to the apartment building, I was spray painting on the board, barbecue canceled. Yeah. And the producer saw it and said, I've never seen a guy with such a good attitude. This is unbelievable. And so overnight, they phoned me. It took a while for them to find me because my home was gone.
Yeah, it's gone.
But they found me through my mother-in-law. I was sleeping on the couch with my girlfriend at the time. So she wasn't really my mother-in-law, but my future mother-in-law. And he said, hey, I saw you on the news and your home burning down. He said, can you roll a 50-cent piece across your knuckle? I'm like, what kind of sick person are you? My hands are all burned from pulling people out of a fire. And he's like, oh, no, what I mean is, could you do it? I was like, yes, I could do it in the past. You'll be able to do it again.
Because he knew you were a magician.
Yeah, because he'd seen all the sin in the news. Because they saw, you know, all my burned equipment and my father's equipment and the history of my family had all gone up. And he said, come down to the Dominion Bridge, which is these studios. And he says, I work for 20th Century Fox and we want to hire you as a consultant. And I came down. He said, you're going to roll a 50-cent piece across your knuckle. You're going to teach Eric Stoltz, that was the actor's name, how to roll the 50-cent piece across the knuckle. You're going to teach him some card tricks. And then there was a young magician, Harley Cross was his name. He was an actor that they wanted him to look like a magician because he was playing Eric Stoltz as a boy.
Okay.
And so I taught Harley Cross, who was in lots of films and became fairly well known for a short period of time. I don't know what does now. Never. I'll have to Google him. I taught him a whole bunch of stuff, and while I was doing that, I made friends with Gary Paller. They were doing a stunt where Eric Stoltz was to throw a champagne bottle at a mirror that had to be 10 feet tall and 35 feet long. And I laughed, and the guy sitting next to me said, why are you laughing? I said, that bottle is going to bounce off of that glass, and it's going to nail that actor in the head. And he said, that's not going to happen. He said, no, that's what's going to happen because there's enough surface. It's like a trampoline. And when that bottle bounced off and nailed Eric Stoltz in the head, the guy next to me says, wow, that's pretty impressive. I said, yeah. So we had the day off because this guy had a bruise on his head. The next day I came back, and I didn't know that Gary was a special effects guy. We came back the next day, and there we were in the same room with the same mirror, same bottle. I said, so what are they doing different? He says, oh, we put epoxy in that bottle. It's just going to smash it all to bits. I said, it's going to do one of two things. It's going to punch a hole through that mirror, the size of the bottle, or it's going to bounce off and kill our lead. And it punched a hole. Just perfectly through this very expensive mirror. And I laughed. And
which was not their plan.
It wasn't their plan. They wanted it to shatter, to reveal this entire scene behind of all these guys working in a lab, not just a little hole. And we had a big lunch break, and this guy standing next to me says, you were laughing again. I said, yeah. He said, well, how would you do it? I said, well, if I were going to do it, I'd get a glazier. I'd have him score the back of it. And I'd probably have somebody with a hammer hit the edge of the mirror at about the time that the bottle hits, so it sends the vibrations in one direction, the whole thing will shatter. The guy goes, that sounds reasonable. Oh, I went for lunch, came back about 2 hours later, mirror's back in, same bottle, same mirror. And I said, so what are they doing different this time? He says, well, we had a glazier come in and score the back of that. I said, oh, that's pretty clever. And he says, and we put these little squibs there, like charges around the edge, and they'll act like a hammer and send the vibration towards the middle. And they're set off by a little light, so when the bottle passes, they'll go. And I'm like, that's a clever idea. Who came up with that? And he says, you did. And if it doesn't work, you're fired. And I was just there to teach rolling a quarter across my hand. I'm like, how can I get fired for, you know, opening? But I understood. It was like I opened my mouth and made, I do that a lot. And it shattered, went perfect. Everybody clapped and cheered. And Gary looked at me and said, you want to make $65 an hour? And I'm going, well, I'm making that now, doing the technical thing, but I won't be doing it for a while. And he said, well, this will be 10 hours a day every day, and we'll pay you double time after 10 hours. And I was like,
for the rest of the shoot.
So what am I doing? He says, you're a technical advisor. To who? He said, me. I'm the special effects guy. I'm like, yes, sir.
Okay.
I didn't know it was him. It was like, wow.
Yeah. You thought he was a guy.
I thought he was a guy, like everybody else standing around. And Gary was a genius, and I worked on so many films with him.
So that was the beginning of that relationship.
It was the beginning.
So
all of a sudden,
now, you were in Vancouver at the time, and he was shooting in L.A.? Or?
No, it was shooting right in Vancouver.
Oh, okay.
Vancouver is the second largest producer of English spoken films in the world.
Really?
All the X-File movies are filmed there, Divergent, all. You'd be amazed at how much. And I niched into a market by meeting a guy named Mark, and Mark ran a props company. And he phoned me up once because he needed a prop of magic trick. And when he met me and saw that, you know, I wasn't a collector, that I was a hoarder, I was a gold mine for him to get stuff from. Okay. He's like, I'm looking for, you know, a boat oar. I have one of those in the basement. And next thing I knew, I was working on Hallmark films, which were, you know, made for movies of the week kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so I did tons of those, and Double Toil and Trouble with Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen, and Halloween Town, I made the bag where the broom came out. Okay. But, you know, and then I got in with Saban Brothers. Well, this is stuff I've never shared with anybody. The Saban Brothers, they asked me to come and teach an actor how to do some stuff, but it was going to be very difficult because they wore gloves, and they were only three-finger gloves, and they were very large gloves because they were turtle gloves. Saban Entertainment. Okay. They were the creators of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Yeah. And so I got to be a Ninja Turtle. When they made the television version of it, they called it Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, The Next Mutation. And they added another turtle. Oh, this is embarrassing. I should never have began this trail. They made a new one, and they wanted a demographic that attracted women, so they created Venus de Milo. And I was the girl turtle. Yay me. But she had these little balls that she flew around her hand, and she had a fan, and the ball would float on the top. And I made Shredder's little gloss things that shot, and they were flamethrowers. That's very popular now. Adam Wilbur has the little shooting fires. Well, I had them on the back in little tubes that Shredder wore and shot at the villains. Yeah.
Kind of like Wolverine.
Wolverine looking. And that was with group Laughing Skull Productions. Oh, they had such great names for all the production companies back then. Yep, I was the girl turtle.
So you had a full mask, and obviously it wasn't your voice, I guess.
Yeah.
They were just kind of...
Oh, I was just... They had four people to be a turtle. Yeah. You know, there was somebody that was a lot smaller that was filmed when they were fighting all the other actors. Then there was a martial arts guy, and they fought, and then there was myself and the facial character. Although it was all bladder, it was all, you know, air bladders. Yeah. To move the face and animatronics in the back of it, they still needed the person to act out in mime. And then there was... You know, the hand skills. Yeah. So either you were like really great at nunchucks, or you were great at doing magic and rolling balls across your fingers and stuff in giant foam gloves. Yeah, not one of my prouder moments. I've worked on some films that you've never heard of, like a television show called Three, which only had two episodes.
That's funny. Three with two episodes, okay.
I worked on one called Mercy Point. More. Star Trek meets... St. Elmo's, you know, the hospital.
Okay.
I worked on Mantis. Oh, go Google Mantis. That was one where it was a African American paraplegic who put on a suit that allowed him to walk, and he shot darts that froze people.
Okay.
Oh, if anybody saw it, they had nothing to do with their lives at that time because and the demographic was so weird. They were just trying to get anybody. So it was like it was the street savvy Jewish scientist with the African American superhero with the Hispanic street girl meeting, you know, the Irish cop. It was like
somebody's going to fit in that demographic somewhere.
They just shot
was this
blast.
Like on the what network? I mean, was it like NBC
somewhere on
cable
UPN
or?
UPN network?
Oh, I remember UPN.
Yeah,
sure,
UPN. All of the networks, Fox. Mm-hmm. Name a television series.
Well, you were talking about X Files. You work with David Duchovny and all that.
I certainly
what
did.
Do you do with them?
I made magic tricks. I made. Lots of things, things like pinball machines explode and all sorts of odd things.
So it wasn't necessarily just magic you were doing; they were just kind of special effects.
Okay. Using magic principles.
A lot
principles.
Of things happened weird. They were like an alien type of thing.
Absolutely. You know, I probably seen 9 episodes of the X Files in my entire life.
Really?
We worked 7 and 7, and so you were 7 days on, 7 days off, and there was no time to watch the episodes. And in between that, I was still doing my magic career, jumping out, and getting onto cruise ships, and coming back. And so I was called in when I was needed.
You did 7 days on the ship, and then come back.
Oh, I'd go out for 5 days on the ship and jump the ship and come back and work again for things. And I had to get over it because I had to get away from the film because they have no respect for your time. Any person that's listening to this that's in the film will totally get it. Your life doesn't exist. It's the film and nothing else. So you work for 12, 14, 16 hours. They have to give you 12 hours off. So let's say you start the very first day filming at 8 o'clock. You should end at 8, but you don't end at 8. You end at 10 or 11. Let's say you end at 11. Well, the next day they can't start till 11. So now you're going 12 hours. Now you're getting off at 11, but you work maybe till 12 or 1 to be finished. Now maybe it's 2 in the morning when you get finished. So the next day they can't start till 2 o'clock in the afternoon. There were times when I would come in and turn on the bedroom light just to look to remember what my wife looked like, because I wasn't seeing her. In as much as I was home, I wasn't home.
Yeah.
But the craft service was great. Food was awesome. I worked on Nightmare Cafe, which was with Robert Englund, the guy from Freddy Krueger.
Yeah, sure.
And I got a phone call. I was the go-to guy if they didn't have an answer. And this one was, I arrived on the set, and the props guy takes me into a production meeting. They said, well, here's the deal. We have this 1.5-minute segment in the show, and you need to be able to make it so that the principal can do it. I said, sure, what is it? He says, he's going to juggle 3 eggs. 2 eggs should disappear. The 3rd egg he cracks, and a baby chick comes out. He throws the baby chick in the air, and it bursts into flames.
I said, and so how do we do that?
Okay, it's doable. Really? I said, good. He said, how much time do I have? I said, well, today's the day. I'm sorry, the day is when they refer to filming. It's like on the day. I said, he said, today's the day. I said, today as in today is the day? He's like, yeah. I said, how many hours do I have to the day? And he said, about 6.
Yeah.
Like, can Mr. Englund juggle? No. Awesome. That's a great start. I'll need some eggs. I'll need a box of baby chicks, live baby chicks. I need some sponge balls. Nerf balls would be great. I need some powder. I need some elastic. And I need a trailer. Please get me to it as fast as you can.
Yeah.
And over the next 6 hours, I developed the entire thing so that Robert Englund stood behind the bar rail in this cafe and moved his arms like he was juggling, while I laid below juggling up, which I'd never done in my life, but learned to juggle upwards instead
that day.
Learned to juggle up with two wooden eggs and one hollowed egg, so I could tell the difference as I juggled. And then I tossed the hollow egg high as I retained the two, so it gave the appearance of 2 eggs disappearing out of his hands.
Yeah.
He then cracked that egg. While he was cracking the egg on the rail, I was extracting from his left sleeve a Nerf ball that I'd carved to sort of look like a baby chick. I got ahead of myself. I put a baby chick in his left hand. He cracked the egg and then opened the two hands to show the baby chick.
Yeah.
As he dropped the shell, I extracted from his right sleeve the Nerf ball that had been powdered with white powder to look sort of like a baby chick on elastic into the other hand. And then as he brought the two hands together and dumped the baby chick down, I sent the ball of fire into the air as he threw his hands up by shooting a little flamethrower from below the edge of the stage using flash paper wrapped really tight with some gunpowder. And we did it in 2 takes.
In 2 takes?
2 takes.
Holy cow.
I used to, now I'm bragging, but I used to be called 2-take Farquhar. They would always take the first front and it worked, and they'd take a second one as a secondary shot. We did a thing, Poltergeist the Legacy, and they hired Sarah McLachlan as the housewife who would be kidnapped out of the shopping center parking lot. And David Charvet, the actor from Baywatch, was going to put a sword through Sarah McLachlan in this coffin. And we set it up all really great, where the coffin lowered in the back so you could still see her face in an open window. Yeah. While the sword went in, her body was out of the way. And I explained to her in very nice terms how she was in no danger. And then when it came time, she wasn't very good at expressing danger because she
knew
she wasn't
in danger.
Yeah. And so we filmed it several times in a row with the actor putting the sword in, and nothing was happening, and there was no reaction, and it was going to be bad.
Yeah.
And they were talking about replacing or just removing the scene. And I have a funny story that relates to it. My brother was a giant fan of Sarah McLachlan and went to her first a big festival. And
is she a singer, Sarah McLachlan?
Yeah.
From Ireland?
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Canadian.
Canadian, okay.
Sarah did her first big music festival, and my brother wanted to say something clever to her when he met her at the signing table. And so he leaned over the table as the clever person my brother is, and Scott said, I love you so much I'd kill a president for you. And she had security remove him from the grounds. He thought it was funny.
Yeah.
But I think he was her first official stalker.
Yeah.
So I said to the director at this moment, when he said there was no fear and nothing was going to happen, I said, I think you have to bring in camera B so that we have both crews in here, and you'll want to film this because we're going to have to do it in one take.
Mm-hmm.
He said, why? I said, she's going to be very frightened. It's going to be a very genuine effect, but you're only going to get one opportunity. And so the director agreed with me, brought in the second camera. We took 20 minutes to relight everything, to get everything perfect. And then I said, Sarah, this time I'm going to be putting the sword in. And they put me in a full tux suit so I looked just like David Charvet did. And I was ready for the moment. And when they said rolling, I said, now you just relax in there and be happy. You know, I don't think you'll know this, but my brother met you a long time ago. I think he was your first stalker. He said he'd kill a president for you. And then I closed the coffin door.
And so the look on her
Look on her face was genuine fear as I put a sword into the box. And then her manager requested me removed from the set and the lot.
And after that scene?
Immediately after the scene, I was removed from the lot.
Because she told him.
Yes. And I didn't come back until the end of that episode when all them left. And the director came in and said, I don't know what you said or what you did, but it was awesome.
So they were going to have you back, even though.
Oh yeah, I was coming back. I was. Yeah, it's the only set I've ever been fired off of, but it was pretty cool.
Well, you've had a lot of experiences then on television. Not only that, so you actually hadn't been on the stage in front of the camera so much, I guess. At that time.
I've done ones like that. I had my own television series when I was 13 years of age in CBC, and that ran 21 episodes.
Were you doing magic at that time?
Yeah, it was all magic. Okay.
Your own series?
My own television series.
13 years. Now, how did that happen?
My friend Billy Stewart's mother was a producer at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and I hired Billy to be my assistant for a couple of magic shows at the Lobster Carnival, and she came and watched and thought I was a clever young man, and they'd already filmed all these things with Ed Fernandez, Magical Interludes, that they were filming and showing, they liked those, and so they decided that they would have a few budget restraints, and they moved towards something else. So it was a shoestring budget, and I created magic tricks using the same boxes with different things, like, you know, a tip-over box could be used to make something appear, but I could also have two rabbits and put a white one in, show the box empty first, put a white one in, then pull out a black rabbit, and then show the box still empty. And it was stupid. I wore red polyester flared pants with a white satin shirt. And it's really funny because...
Well, that was a thing in the 70s.
It sure was. And I had the... you wouldn't know the reference, but René Simard was a big, huge Canadian pop star. And I had the pageboy haircut to look just like him. And I had a real fan base of young girls. It was I did the fair circuit when I was 13.
Wow.
Was,
you were signing all the autographs and they were coming and getting pictures with you.
Yeah, the Olympics in Montreal, 76. It was a pretty big thing. I opened for big acts like Tommy Hunter was a big Canadian act, and Anne Murray. Hmm. And I had a whole career before.
Did you have an agent?
No, my father, because my father was a really great magician at the end of his career because he wasn't feeling well and with his arthritis acting to the point where he couldn't do it. And it was an interesting time. Annabelle Stewart put this together. It aired, and I signed off that, you know, I got my money, one-time buyout, and 100% buyout on top of the money. So I was done about 10 years ago. So we're talking 30-some years after that. Okay. I'm working in a bar in Hay River, Northwest Territories, for a big corporation, and the sponsor putting it together goes, says, anybody tell you sound a lot like this obnoxious little kid on Saturday morning? I stayed up through the night. Wait for Saturday morning, and there I was in all my glory. It's still sold to cable networks. And
it was
like,
still on.
Oh,
30
yeah.
Years later. 30,
and it's just as terrible as
nope,
I remember.
So you're not getting any residuals, obviously.
Not a dime. I have no idea where it sells.
How much were you paid for back then? I mean, I guess your dad was your agent, and he negotiated.
Oh, I got a whopping sum of, I think it was $97 an episode. It was awesome.
And you did how many episodes?
21 of them.
Okay.
Yep. It was
And it was a half-hour show.
Time. They were 20-minute shows.
Okay, well, yeah. Provide for commercial time and everything.
Everything, and they were terrible.
But you didn't have, like, a peanut gallery or an audience necessarily.
Oh, no. I had a guy with a tape recorder that went...
Okay.
Oh, yeah, it was awesome. It's as bad as you can imagine. And if anybody finds
color,
them,
at least.
And you want to make some money, blackmail me, because I will pay to get the copy myself, because I don't have copies of my photographs of the production. I've got lots of pictures of me with my terrible hair holding the canes and all the studio shots, but not a single stitch of
film. What was the name of the series again?
Magical Interludes.
Magical
Interludes. So special.
Was your name Sean Farquhar at that
it
time?
It sure
did you go
was.
By Magic Sean? Or
no, I always... Okay. Do you know what? One time I thought about changing my name. It was 1983, Santa Barbara at a PCM convention. I was hanging out with a young lady named Katie Grable, who was Lee Grable's daughter, and I was having just the grandest time, and she invited me to a picnic that her father was putting together, and at the picnic, David Copperfield arrived, and I was like wide-eyed and was like, wow.
Yeah.
And we talked for a few minutes. It was very cool. It was a year later, I saw him again, and I said, hi, my name's Sean Farquhar, and I said, you know, I've been really thinking about, you know, changing my name to something, you know, that's catchy, like a David Copperfield thing. He said, really? Because, you know, I spent 10 minutes learning it. And I was like, oh. And I went, that's the best advice I ever had. And the amount of people that ask me, you know, people go, why did you keep the name? I said, well, I promised my parents I would keep it no matter how short it makes my career. Nobody believes it's real. The biggest popular thing that ever happened to me was Shrek. When Shrek came out, people actually kind of recognized the name. They're like, oh, it's like Lord Farquhar. It's like...
Because that was his name.
It was. Now I want to get my
Lord
own
Farquhar.
Papers.
Oh, okay.
Now I want to get my own papers because you can buy a small plot of land in Scotland and you can get your laird, your papers. So now I want to get it so I can be Lord Farquhar.
And have your own property, yeah.
Well, we have a castle. We have a castle. My family has a castle. Castle Braemar in Inverness is the Farquhar Castle, the seat of my clan. I've seen the crib where my clan's leaders, clan chiefs, were born in these oak beautiful oak crib with the crest on the back of it.
You've been there? You visited?
Oh, yeah, then? Several times.
Well, I mean, if it's your place, I mean, shouldn't they give you, I guess, at least free passage? You don't have to pay for...
You heard the word Scottish, right?
That's right, okay. Nothing's free. yeah, so they got rid of that a long time ago, castle. So
the castle's still there. It's where they hold the Highland Games. It's one of the few fully standing castles. And our next-door neighbor is Castle Balmoral, which is the Queen's Summer Palace.
Yeah, okay.
She's 10 minutes down the road. And one of the greatest experiences ever was I took my daughter to see Castle Braemar. And as we're standing in front of Castle Braemar, overlooking the property, the Outriders came by, which are the Queen's private guard on motorcycle. Hmm. And then a few minutes later came the Queen's car. And I saw the Outriders go by. And I said, Hannah, the Queen's coming. Let's walk towards the end of the property and wave. She says, do you think so? And literally within minutes, they came to the Queen's stand, and we're waving at the Queen as she drove by.
She
of course,
right?
You know, no, the windows are dark. You can't see anything. But you know she's in the car. And then more Outriders afterwards. So then we made a trip over to Balmoral, and there's a big distillery
Scotch
above.
Distillery right there.
So we went up to that because that's the best view of the castle, so that you can see down. And bought a bottle while we were there because I kind of like Scotch. Well, you know that from the 4S Society.
Yes, we are all members of the 4S. Can't tell you guys about that.
Yeah. We don't talk about it. It's like Fight Club.
Fight Club. you say Castle Braemar kind of makes me think of Castle Grayskull. I can just imagine you on top of there.
By the power of Grayskull!
He-Man.
Oh, you just dated yourself.
Oh, boy, really.
That's
so
awesome.
You were.
I watched it with my nephews. Yeah, that's my answer.
Well, see, I watched Pee Wee Herman with my son.
Yes.
When it was growing. And I understand that's, I think, available. You can see through Hulu now.
I bought the whole DVD set for my daughter.
Pee Wee Herman?
Oh, yeah.
Pee Wee's Playhouse? Fantastic,
awesome.
Yeah. With Larry Fishburne, Steve Lawrence, when he was
unbelievable.
Cowboy.
Great material.
It was very good. And so going forward then, and being on television then with Ellen DeGeneres, was that kind of a surprise, or did you try to get booked
kind
on there?
Kind of a surprise. I almost missed the gig.
Yeah.
I have a dear friend, Juliana Chen, and Juliana had a gig going to Iceland, and she has this illusion that Roy Shank had built, and I'd redesigned, and there was something wrong with it, and it needed to be fixed. And so that day, I was sitting in my friend Charlie Grant's special effects lab, because we use it as one of our warehouses for storing and to build stuff, because Charlie's brilliant, and I was fixing this prop. And the phone rang, and I looked down, and it was a number I didn't recognize, and probably a telemarketer or something. I'll just leave it alone, because
get back later.
I'll get back to it. If it's somebody who needs, the phone rang again about an hour later, and I ignored it. And I was on a very short 6-hour deadline, and then I finally got it done. And the truck arrived because I had to have it fixed before the truck arrived. Take it to be airshipped to Finland. So it made it. And as it made it, the phone rang again. I said, "Wow, this person is persistent. I'll answer." And I said, "Hi," and they said, "Hi, my name is," and it was Teresa, and I'm executive producer of the Ellen DeGeneres Show. And I said, "Hi, Teresa, how can I help you?" Because I didn't know what the Ellen DeGeneres Show was.
Yeah, you're in Canada, and they don't broadcast that up there.
Well, apparently they do broadcast it, because my wife and daughter were massive fans of it. I said, "Yes, I'd be interested in being on your show. Where is it filmed?" Pretty good indication that you know nothing about it.
Yeah.
I said, "Well, it's filmed right in Burbank at the Warner Brothers Studios." So she was giving me a specific as opposed to a city. I was like, the Burbank Studios, that's awesome. I'd be Burbank. Wow. Well, I'm not at home right now. I'm in a warehouse. I need to check my schedule. Can you call me back? Well, when should I call? In about an hour. It'll take me about an hour. Mm-hmm. It took me about 30 minutes to get home. I discussed it, and they said, "Yeah, we'd love to have you on. We saw, you know, your YouTube videos." So then they suggested some material for me to do, and I didn't want to do the material. And so I said, "No, I'm sorry, I won't be able to do that," because they wanted me to shorten the material to fit the time constraint. And I had no interest in shortening my material, cutting the legs
Which
off my children.
They
wanted me to do Shape of My Heart, done to a shorter version, because they had the rights. Warner Brothers has rights to the musical publications thing, and they had a shorter version. They wanted me to do
Just
the short
play.
Version.
Yeah.
And I said, "You know what? I would rather not do it at all and not be on the show, but thank you." Mm-hmm. And then she said, "Well, do you have other materials?" Yeah, I have other materials. "Well, send me a video of some stuff." So I shot a video that night and sent it off to them. And then they said, "Do you have other material? Because we love all that." I sent them 6 videos of 3 tricks each over the next 4 or 5 days. Mm-hmm. And then they picked through it to pick what they wanted. And I wore different outfits for each one of them. And they told me what to wear for the show and everything. And it was so funny, because when I finally told Laurie and Hannah, I said, "So we're going to go to Los Angeles. They've invited all of us. And I'm going to go on this show called The Ellen DeGeneres Show." And Hannah said, "Oh, that's great." And went upstairs. And Laurie's like, really? And I was like, yeah. She says, that's pretty spectacular. And I was like, oh. The Hannah came down and said, you know, if you ever get the chance to be on TV with anybody else, you should go on that show with the lady who dances with all the people because she's awesome.
Yeah.
And my wife goes, that's Ellen.
That is Ellen.
And all of a sudden, Hannah looked at me and her eyes changed. She goes, you're cool. And it was the first time in my life that my daughter thought I was cool.
Yeah.
In fact, if you ever watch the interview on Ellen, I take a minute right at the start to thank her
because
I said, when I told my daughter I was going on Ellen, it was the first time in my life she ever said I was cool. Up to that point, I was just dad. Dad was dad.
Yeah.
Dad was goofy. Dad's a geek. Now, dad does card tricks.
Didn't you have her in the show also?
I tried to get her to be on the show, and they said that they'd have to pay every person some sort of thing, but I didn't get any money out of it, but they couldn't have her on the show. And I was like, okay. So then I went and had a photograph printed that had her holding a playing card, a 10 of diamonds, so that I could then do it and make sure my daughter's face was on the show because – she's my pride and joy.
Right.
So then when it came time to film my episode, Ed Norton had just finished. The guy who plays Sheldon from Big Bang had been on. And it was my turn. And they came up to the dressing room, knocked on the door, and they said, so you're all coming down? And I was like, well, if we can. And I said, oh, yes, we've pulled out two of the people so that your daughter and your wife can be in the audience. Mm-hmm. They don't allow children in the audience, the Ellen DeGeneres Show. And so Hannah was the first and only kid to sit in the audience.
Okay.
And I was only supposed to be one segment, and it extended after the break into another segment because she really liked it. And they had to run up and get more magic for me to do because it was more stuff than I'd planned to do.
I'll change it up.
Oh, no, no, because they wanted us to come back to the end of the show I did my torn to pieces routine.
Yeah.
And while the break was on, Ellen leans across and she says, well, this is going really well. You know, when your daughter sees this, you're going to be cool for a very long time. I said, you know, she's in the audience. She goes, really? And you saw Ellen literally start scanning the audience, sees Hannah. She'd hurt her leg that day, Ellen, and was on some medication for the leg. And it was her first day to go film America's American Idol as a judge. Mm-hmm. So we filmed 3 hours earlier than she would normally be. So everything was off for her. But she literally put her hand on my head to get up out of her seat because of the pain in her leg, pushed herself up and strutted right up to Hannah, grabbed Hannah and started dancing with Hannah in the aisle,
wow.
Shook Lori's hand, and then came back and sat down. She looks at me and says, now you're cool for a couple years.
I think you're gold.
Yeah. The show's over. I'm sitting in my dressing room. I'm like trying to relive the whole thing. You know, I didn't eat anything before the show because, you know, you're all – but yeah. I've got this huge, massive basket full of stuff. I've got a free flip video thing that they've given me, a free Ellen underwear, the coffee mug and everything. I'm looking at all the regalia. I go, this is pretty cool. The knock on the door, and the executive producer, Teresa Stanley, goes, hi, Sean. Ellen wanted me to give this to you. Hands me a DVD, and I said, it's of the show? She said, No. That'll be tomorrow. I said, what's the DVD of? She says, well, we filmed the breaks, and we filmed Hannah and Ellen dancing.
Oh, cool.
So we went home to, at the time we lived in Millardville, big Millardville. We went to...
Is that in Canada?
Yeah, in Canada, okay. A small little Millardville, which is cool because I said Millardville on television, so the mayor of Millardville came and knocked on my door and gave me a pin.
Holy cow.
Richard Stewart was like, that is the most awesome thing ever. You said Millardville on TV. It's like, that rocks. Richard's a big fan of magic. He's a super great mayor, too, and he's been there forever. And
how big is Millardville? Like 1,200 people?
It's not big.
As big as Colin, Michigan?
It's now incorporated into a city, the city of Coquitlam. I no longer live in Coquitlam.
Okay.
Yeah, Coquitlam is the native Indian word for smells like fish. That's the absolute truth.
Okay.
It's the absolute truth. And Millardville is duck town. Millard is duck in French, and Ville is town.
Mallard,
Millardville. So yeah. I used to live in duck town in smells like fish county. And now... Coquitlam has taken over, so Millardville doesn't even exist. It's like...
So it is like Colon, Michigan. It's
yeah.
Like, Colon's the end of the... Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And so I moved out to Maple Ridge, which was not a city until this year. We got a McDonald's, and we got an American department store, Target. Woo! And if you ever want to see Millardville, you can go to my YouTube channel. Every year at Christmas time, I drive down Main Street. It's it's a 30-second video. I go from one end of Main Street to the other to show you the Christmas decorations. It's very special.
Both of them.
Yeah, it's very nice.
Now, you've been back then on Ellen the second or third time?
I've been invited back twice, and I actually haven't appeared on it, only because my schedule hasn't permitted. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know... I was invited to do the David Letterman show, and I turned it down because I already
during
had
that Magic Week when those
that Magic Week when they did it. I was invited to go on, and it was so weird. I was in a negotiation to book a hotel for a convention, and they're real hard-nosed on their side. I'm being real hard-nosed on my side. And they're going, well, you know what? This is kind of, you know, a medium level. It's not a high level, blah, blah, blah. And the phone rang. And I said, I'm sorry. And I've learned now that when the phone rings and it's somebody I don't know, I actually pick it up from the Ellen experience.
You've learned,
So I looked down and I said, I'm sorry, I don't know that number. It looks like a New York number. I have to take this call. And I answered the phone and said, hello, Sean Farquhar speaking. And they said, hi, this is Mike. I'm a producer at the David Letterman Show. We'd like to talk about having you on Monday. This is a Friday. And I'm like, this Monday? And he goes, yes. I said, well, Mike from the Dave Letterman Show, I'm sort of in a meeting at this very moment. Can I call you back in just 5 minutes? I just have to say goodbye to these people, and then I'll have, you know, your undivided attention, and we can talk. He goes, certainly, just give me a call back. I hung up the phone and said, look, I really don't need to discuss this anymore with you. Do you want to have us or not? And they were like, yes. Then the one guy said, was that really the David Letterman Show? I said, uh-huh. I said, I have to go now. I live 2 minutes away, so I raced back to home, set up. And then they said, you have to come in on Monday. We'll fly you out on Sunday night. You'll film on Monday.
Friday.
It was the Friday. And I said, unfortunately, I have a gig. Okay, I had a gig, but it wasn't a real gig. What I had was I promised my daughter that I would take her school on a field trip to see a mine, Britannia Mine. And the school didn't have enough money.
That's M-I-N-E.
M-I-N-E.
Not like a mime who walks
like a coal mine.
Yeah, okay.
I planned on taking them to this. Yeah, that would have been good because it was a mime. I wouldn't have cared.
Yeah.
I went to the school. The school was supposed to do the whole project, and they couldn't afford it. So I rented a bus for the school, the class to go. When I say class at school, which is it's the same thing for that. You know, there isn't a lot of people in the school. Well, they needed insurance. That would be my insurance to the bus for everybody to go. So if I didn't go, the class trip was canceled completely. Mm-hmm. And I'd already promised to my daughter that we were going, so we were going. So I couldn't say, I'm taking my daughter on a school field trip. So I said, I have a gig. It's a high-paying client, and there's no way I can get out of it. Because I figured that was better than saying, no, I'm sorry. And he said, give me the client's name, and we'll contact him. I think you'll find that the power of David Letterman's name pulls a lot of weight, and they'd be happy. And I said, okay, let me be straight with you. And then I explained it to him. And he's laughing on the other end. I mean, outright laughing. And he says, let me go talk to my boss, and I'll get back. I said, do you think there's a chance? He said, no, I think my boss wants a really good laugh, and I'll be right back to you. He comes back and he says, I said, you know, you're an entire week of filming. He says, no, we don't film on
film for like 3 days.
Yeah, we don't film on Friday or something, and we're doing the other two together.
Right.
And the Wednesday is already with Michael Lamar, so the other two are filming two on the Monday, two on the whatever.
Yeah.
And they had some schedule that was all convoluted. I said, awesome. I said, so he says, we're going to put you in our file, and we'll have you back again sometime. I said, really? He says, no, I'm just trying to make you feel good. To this day, my daughter talks about that field trip with such glowing comments, and all her friends, which she's going through school all the way through with, because we stayed basically in the same area, still rave about the field trip. I did the right move because I saw how they filmed it, and it was not filmed for the grace of magic. The things they did, the people were not good. I was blessed not to be on it. I was happy. And the funny thing was, I said no to them. The next day, I get a phone call from an agent who's in a panic going, Sean, what are you doing on Monday night? And I said, absolutely nothing. I turned down the David Letterman Show. And he goes, yeah, whatever. thinking I was joking. So I've got a mining company. And I'm like, really? He says, it's a Norwegian mining company. It's Norwegian Independence Day. And they're having a giant thing at the Vancouver Aquarium. They need a walk around. And they'll pay you $2,500 to do some card tricks walk around. I said, I'm in. It was like, really? He says, yep. I said, great. So I arrived at this. I went and did the field trip with my daughter for the day. And then it switched over. Went down to the Vancouver Aquarium. Had a beautiful salmon dinner. Went out, did an hour walk around. The only American was the producer of the show. The rest were all Norwegian. We all sang the Norwegian national anthem. And I know a little bit about that because I've got a lot of Viking friends. It was an awesome evening. And then the producer said to me, boy, we're really lucky to get you. I said, yeah, it was either that or me be on the Letterman Show this evening. And he goes, oh, you're joking. I said, no, actually, I'm not.
And you told him the story.
Told him the story. Told him who the magician was going to be on that night. And he said, I really can't fathom that. The next day, the agent phones me and goes, you weren't joking. I said, well, how do you know? And he says, because the client phoned me this morning and said, oh, my God, he turned down the Letterman Show to stay with us. I said, well, it wasn't exactly the order, but I'm fine with that.
Because you're so important.
It was such a cool feeling. Mm-hmm. I've done 7 events for the Norwegian Mining Company around the world for them now. Mm. They're one of my most affluent customers, and he tells the story for every one of them. He loves us. Yeah. He loves us so much, he turned down David Letterman to come be with us.
That's interesting. And so you've been working a lot of cruise ships, obviously, then, too, but I wanted to go back kind of full circle to the beginning over there where you were talking about your apartment being burned down. That had something to do, I guess, were you in a comedy club, or were you in the
cruise ship? I was at Laughlines Comedy Club.
And tell a story about kind of what, how that came about.
Disgruntled person who came in, was very loud. He was obnoxious to all the other acts. I was headlining. So many fun stories about Laughlines. I had Robin Williams drop in on an evening and asked to do 10 minutes in front of me. After he did an hour and 20 minutes, I'd already packed and put anything in the van. I sat and watched the end of the show. That's when we were working on Jumanji.
Yeah.
And he wanted to come in and watch me, but then he got carried away and did his own set instead.
And so you ended up doing nothing.
I did nothing, but I got paid. And the club owner thought it was the greatest thing in the world because, you know, Robin Williams came in to see me. Whatever. So I did this club this one night, and there was a guy who was rude, and all the acts before me, they were... And when it was my turn, you know, I got up and I said, I was a different Sean than I am now. I was very caustic. I was working, you know, blue collar clubs and biker bars.
You had to do something to grab their attention.
Yeah, I did shows for the Hells Angels and all the affiliates and things like that. And I was in.
Affiliates? Hells Angels has affiliates?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. Farm clubs.
Those farmers, yeah, those are badass guys.
You know, just like a pro baseball team, you got to have the
farm
teams, and then the pledges in, and then everything. Haven't you ever watched Sons of Anarchy?
Like with hockey teams, they got junior teams.
And, exactly. Yeah,
okay.
So I did all that stuff, and on this particular, I used to have all heckler lines. I had tons of heckler lines because I had tons of hecklers because of the style I did. Mm-hmm. I did one where I heckled a guy who came in late in the show, and it turned out he was an acquitted hitman who was on the front page of the newspaper that day, and he came in with a hooker on each arm, and I picked on him and brought him onto the stage and made fun of him. And then afterwards, I'm looking at the club owner, Mark, laughing his butt off and holding up this paper like, what? And he showed it to me. Oh,
you're
my God.
Hitman.
And I walked across, and I apologized, saying, I didn't know who you were, and I'm so sorry, and please forgive me. I didn't sleep for 6 days. I every rustle of a tree, and 6 days later I opened up the paper, and there was a picture of this guy dead on his front lawn outside of his car. The reason he was acquitted was they'd killed off his witnesses to get him out of the prison so they could get to him to get rid of him because they needed him dead. And yeah, Ross Filippone, you can Google that one too.
And he wasn't really laughing so much, I guess.
He didn't laugh at all.
Apologies.
Well, no, he was really cool. When he accepted my apology, he was very loud. He said, don't worry about it, you're one funny effer. He didn't use the word effer. Shook my hand, patted me on the back really loud. The whole club could hear it. He said, that was the best thing I've ever seen. And then he lowered his voice and said, now get the F away from me. And it was like, oh my God. And all I thought was, he did all that as a show, and now he's going to come kill me. All went through my head.
But so after that week, you know, you knew.
You think I wouldn't stop going to Laughlines Comedy Club after that?
You would have learned something.
This guy was really rude, and I dropped a line. I said, you know, sir, could you just shut up and show me a little respect? I could have been your father if that German Shepherd hadn't beaten me over the fence. And he picked up a beer bottle and threw it towards me and missed. And the club manager got the bouncer, and the bouncer took him out. And when he took him out, he swung at the bouncer, and the bouncer beat him. And the guy stayed outside stewing, thinking it was my result, that it was my fault, followed me home to an apartment building which had 13 apartments, tore off a piece of his T-shirt, shoved it into a beer bottle, and burned the place to the ground. And
That night.
That night I went into – well, he stayed there. I actually saw him when I was in the ambulance having glass picked out of my hands and my face. I saw him, and it was like, go get the police. You got to go talk to him. And he had gasoline breath and torn T-shirt. And, yeah, I did it. And
but you were there helping to – save people.
I went into the building 9 times. I pulled out a man who weighed 250 pounds like he weighed nothing. I jumped an entire story on a building and pulled a person off a balcony. I broke a door down with one arm to a couple that were going to be married in a week, and they were engaged in premarital entertainment on the floor. He ran past me. When I banged on the door and it fell right off the hinges, that's adrenaline. I couldn't do that in my life, but it went right off the hinges. He stood up and ran towards me like he was going to beat me, butt naked, and I just screamed fire, and he could see the smoke coming up, and he just pushed me aside and ran out, leaving his naked future bride on the ground.
I don't know that she actually became the bride after that.
You know what? I never met them afterwards. We didn't ever see them again, but in the film footage you can see of all the news cameras coming, she's in a green hockey jacket that she keeps pulling down, trying to cover as much as she can.
Did you injure your back or something when you jumped?
I burned both my hands severely pulling a bird cage. Mm-hmm. I lost one bird. Well, I lost two birds in the fire. One died, and the other one stayed. Ended up in a bifold door of a closet, which filled with water, and the bird survived and was in my show for another 9 years. We renamed him Lucky because he was burned all the toes off of him.
Yeah.
Ann was the veterinarian at Night Owl Veterinarian Services in Vancouver. I took the birds there because smoke inhalation burns, and I brought them there, but it was very expensive. And you have to remember, I had nothing. I lost everything. I had a little Chevette with a Hughes suit table inside with the Hippity Hop Rabbit and a sliding dive box for kids' parties.
That's pretty much
and
it.
I'd just come off of doing, you know, a world cruise, and the comedy show had been gone in. And so I had nothing. And I used what money I had left was spent on trying to heal the birds. And I remember when I ran out of money and I went into Ann and I said, Ann White was her name, I should send her another card. I try every once in a while just to tell her I'll never forget her. I went into the vets and I said, look, I have to take the birds now. You have to tell me what I have to do, but I can't afford to keep them there. And she said, if you take them home, they'll die, and I won't let you take them home. She said, I will pay for it from this day forward. They were in there 30 more days and with no expenses whatsoever. All the birds lived. They were in my show for years afterwards. Yep. She was very cool about that. Years later, I'm talking, that was 88, so 2005 or 6, I was on a cruise ship, and this guy walks up to me, he goes, on the ship, signing, you know, you Sean Farquhar from Canada? And I said, I am, sir. He says, do you ever live in New Westminster, Canada? And I said, yes, sir, I did, but I was kind of abruptly removed from New Westminster. And he says, you're a freaking hero. I'm like, I'm sorry. And he says, my best friend's name is Ray, and he says, you're a freaking hero. Ray was a man who had been hit by a car, who managed the building, been hit by a car, and had only returned home that day in a leg cast on both legs with a steel pipe between his legs.
Yeah.
Weighed about 250 pounds. I didn't even know he was home. I'd gone through the building and cleared everybody out, and I got Ray's girlfriend. And when I was counting everybody and making sure everybody was safe, she was going, but Ray's in there. I go, calm down. Ray's in the hospital. I said, no, he came home today.
Yeah, yeah.
So I stormed back in. It was my ninth trip into the fire, through a wall of fire. Picked him up like he was a toothpick.
And the fire department had not yet arrived.
Fire department arrived while I was coming out with Ray. And I was, you know, fixating on smoke, lots of smoke inhalation. And they literally took Ray out of my arms and then helped me out the door. But I was pulling him out like he was just a toothpick.
So the guy said...
Yeah, he says, every time Ray gets drunk, Ray tells the story, because he was high on medication, laying in a bed with, you know, his cast with a bar in between, while the room was fully involved. And he was there going, ha-ha! And then he just saw this, as he describes it, he said, I saw this shining light come through a cloud of smoke and pick me up and take me to safety.
It was Venus de Milo.
Exactly! The Teenage Mutant Turtle coming to the rescue. It was
shooting these things out of her fist.
Around 2001, I had a knock on my door, and I opened the door, and there was this large man standing there, and tall, and like a carpenter. And I said, "Can I help you?" And he says, "Sean." And I said, "Yes." He says, "I'm Chad." Chad was a 9-year-old boy I found underneath of a bed and brought out of the fire. His mother had left, and I looked for Chad, couldn't find him, and then I flipped
his
head over.
He
hid under the bed, and I pulled him out of the fire and took him out. And he and his mom, they had an abusive father who wasn't living in the house, who would come and steal from Chad all the time. Chad came and did school assemblies with me and library shows, and his mother was on welfare, and my wife found a job for her working for, you know, FedEx, and taught her how to do data entry and everything, got her a job. And they were our neighbors across the hall that we were really helping. We didn't live in a beautiful apartment building, don't think anything special.
Okay.
You know, it was a $300 a month place. I was a starving magician. And here was this strapping man standing there, and he says, you know, it was December 28th. 26, I should say, Boxing Day. And he said, I started our Boxing Day. It's a Christmas holiday where you give thanks. And he said, I started our Boxing Day with my mom and I sitting there thinking of all the people in the world who we thank. And we both decided it was you. So I looked you up in the phone book, and I've come over just to say thank you. And it was just unbelievable to see this, you know, guy who was 21 years of age standing there yakking at me, talking.
Yeah.
And, you know, full journeyman carpenter is what he was.
Yeah.
And I was like,
a healthy man.
Look at you, healthy man. How's your mom? She still works at FedEx, everything. It's Loomis became FedEx. started with Loomis. He says, still works there. She's still doing great. I said, and your dad? And he says, don't see him. Don't talk to him. Don't care. And I was like, that's awesome. Because twice I beat his father up for stealing Chad's money. And, yeah, wow. He's a terrible character. But I think of those stories and just go, you know, living in those type of communities and that sort of environment, those people just assaulted the earth.
Yeah.
We had a break-in in that apartment, a prison breakout, and so prisoners escaped. And we woke up in the morning, and I looked out, and underneath of my van was a guy in an orange jumpsuit. And I told Lori, go out to the front, tell the police that he's out back. And, of course, they just screamed, he's out back. By this time, I'm taking pictures with my old SLR of this guy underneath. And all of a sudden, he gets up, looks at me, flips me the bird. So I go back in and lock my balcony door. I tell Lori as she comes back, and I said, well, the police were stupid. They screamed it really loud. I look out, and he's on my balcony. He's climbed up two balcony levels. So apparently jumping one balcony isn't so bad. I did it in the fire. He did it because police were chasing him.
Yeah.
But he doesn't crawl in my apartment. He goes on the side over across and steps on the head of the guy who's laying in the bed, who thinks he's breaking in and doesn't think he's a prisoner who's just waking up, drags the guy in and pummels him on the floor, the prisoner,
the heck out
and
of, yeah.
drags him through the hallway and throws him out the front door where the police dog started to chew him apart. We watched the news that night, and there's this guy all beaten with dog bites dog on bites, him going, well, the residents of 2065 Hamilton dealt with the prisoner on their own.
You don't want to mess with that apartment.
I used to go out in my apartment. The front was a double sliding glass door to a balcony. And I would turn off the lights, turn on one bright light, and it was my mirror. And I'd practice my bird act against this, this glass, and I could see it. And one night I hear applause. And I look out, and the entire apartment building is all sitting out on the lawn
watching.
With drinks in their hands watching me do the act. I've been doing it night after night, and they've been coming night after night to watch it. I was preparing to come to the IBM convention and to compete, and I was practicing the act. And this night, they all decided to clap, and it was like, it's just the first, I got good.
Yeah.
I reached the point where I was good, and they were like, well, he didn't screw up this time, because, you know, I never got through the whole act. Someone would screw up, and I would stop. And this night, I got to the very end, took my bows, and Lori, and they all clapped, and I was like, wow. Yeah, it was a very community feeling building.
Was that your first competition, by the way, then? Or?
My first competition, no, was I competed at a PCM convention in 1984. That was interesting because...
We will have to leave this as a cliffhanger until next week when we finish this story and go in a completely different direction, talking about contests, cruise ships, and being a magic dealer. I certainly want to thank Sean Farquhar for being my guest and taking all the time I wanted to thoroughly tell all these stories. I also want to thank Jason Greck, who is the newest member of the Friends of the Magic Word. He showed his support and appreciation for all that I do here by donating to the Magic Word. Along with his donation, he remarked, I have really enjoyed listening to your podcast. They have allowed me to learn a lot about the world of magic and the people involved. You can show your support through PayPal on a one-time basis or through Patreon on an ongoing basis by hitting the button at the top of the page at themagicwordpodcast.com. Thanks, Jason, and thank you, listeners, for downloading the Magic Word. You can continue the conversation and learn what's coming up by liking us on Facebook at facebook.com/themagicwordpodcast. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and keep shuffling. This is Scotty out.